One of the scribes came near and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, he asked him, "Which commandment is the first of all?" Jesus answered, "The first is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' The second is this, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself.' There is no other commandment greater than these." Then the scribe said to him, "You are right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one, and besides him there is no other, and to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself. This is much more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." When Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." After that, no one dared to ask him any question.
As many of you know, we did go on a mission trip to Detroit this summer. We left on Sunday, August the 4th, and came back on the 11th. We went on the bus. As we said, have bus, we'll travel. The bus did come back, not all in one piece, but it did come back. We left very early on a Sunday, which Rick Rusinak and Brian Thale can attest to, as they saw us off as we left. We drove all day and wound up in Detroit that evening at Northwestern Christian Church Disciples of Christ. That was our home for the week. We slept on church floors. We did have air mattresses, but we slept on church floors. The church has a shower, one shower for female, one shower for male. So the four of us were able to work out a shower schedule pretty easily. We ate there. Also, Rippling Hope provides all of the meals. This is Carl Zerwick, who is the director of Rippling Hope. Some of you may know Carl's name. He was at one time the director of Disciples Volunteering for our denomination. Some of you may have even been on a mission trip with him before. Carl is just, I don't even know how to describe him, right, guys? He's just good.
He's a character.
Definitely. He is a character. He's very much a character. Rippling Hope is a nonprofit organization, an ecumenical nonprofit organization that I actually serve on the board for Rippling Hope, which is one of the reasons that we went and served with them this summer, because it was an organization that I felt very good about serving with, as well as Disciples Volunteering. Rippling Hope is working in Detroit and in El Paso, trying to help people reclaim their communities. In El Paso, we have found that people are afraid to send their youth and groups to El Paso because it's on the other side of the border from Juarez, and they believe that it's a very dangerous place to be. But yet they will send their youth and adults to Detroit. Well, when we get to the end of this, you will see that El Paso is actually one of the safest town, city in the country, because it is on the other side of the border from Juarez. And Detroit is not the safest. In this picture, Carl is showing us the part of Detroit that Rippling Hope serves in. And there we are, the first morning. As we like to say, this is our naive picture. The very first, we look happy, we look rested. That's the fellowship hall at Northwestern Christian Church. And just so you know, this church gives up its church building during the week, during the summer. From May through September, it's Rippling Hope all week long, groups coming in. And then they come and worship on Sunday. They might have a Bible study midweek, but other than that, they give up their whole church building for this effort. So there we are as we begin our journey.
So this is the first day. We went to a one-and-a-half-story house to paint. I guess it was like an office-slash-exercise area.
And bedroom.
The
whole upstairs.
And the lady was supposed to move things, and so we could paint. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of stuff there. So we laid plastic over all that and had to maneuver around this big cactus that was, you'll see, as tall as Steve.
Huge. I've never seen a cactus in a house that big.
So here we are, starting with the walls and working our way to the ceiling. And there's Lou moving some plastic. And Dean Creighton, this is for you. We did use the right paintbrushes, just so you are aware.
We learned.
Little inside joke there, but those are our paintbrushes, and we did, like I said.
We used rollers, too.
Yes.
We didn't do the whole room just with brushes.
And there's our lovely cactus that we had to maneuver around.
And she had tied back the sides so it wasn't out.
Spread, yeah.
But it was still, you had to kind of go around. It was big.
It was really very big.
Of course, if you're from Texas, you know how to work around cactus.
We learned quick.
Yes.
Very quick.
And doing around the windows and the trim. Steve painting himself into a corner.
Literally. It just looks like it.
No.
And just so you know, where Steve is standing, you might be able to see, he's behind a desk sort of thing that has a computer on it. And literally the space between that desk and the wall was what? Like that?
Yeah.
Barely
we
over
had to
a
squeeze
foot.
In between to paint.
That was the homeowner's version of moving things
yeah,
away
we couldn't,
from the wall.
We couldn't
us.
Move anything further away because everything was already in the middle.
I guess I don't know what I'm doing there, but.
Resting. He did that a lot. No.
And there's some of the finished project.
Because it was the walls, the ceilings, the baseboards, and the
stairwell, you'll see. Yeah.
And
there's the stairwell.
Which, by the way, was very dark because the light bulb at the top of the stairs was burned out. So we were literally, there's a picture that Lori didn't put in here, but we were using headlamps to be able to see and paint in there.
Yeah.
And we had to get a scaffold, and it was just...
It was interesting.
Yeah.
It was a very high ceiling, you know, open stairway that, yeah, we had to have a long ladder and... Yeah, it was an all-day paint job.
Yes.
OSHA would not have been proud of our tactics.
And this is us in the front of the house showing our work hands and our finish.
And we're still happy.
And we're still happy. It was fun.
And
the gentleman in front, that's Corey. He's Rippling Hope's intern, right, for the summer. So he worked with us some of the time and also with another group of young men who were also working through another group. Is that right, Lori? Like,
it's like a jobs work program.
Right. So there was the four of them, and then Corey worked for Rippling Hope. So we worked with all of them at various times.
The fence.
Is this me? This is a fence that none of us are going to soon forget.
Right.
From the angle you're looking at it now, the original plan was to take the panels off of the fence, pull the posts out, move it back 10 feet, put posts back in, new posts, and then put the same panels back up. When we got the first panel down, it became evident that that was not going to move back 10 feet.
That gives you an idea of what it looked like.
Right.
It was leaning. It was falling apart. It was being propped up by other boards.
When we pulled it all down, some of the posts were pretty well rotted through. We pulled all of those out. The concrete that was holding it was a chore to get out of those holes. And when we dug the new holes to put in new posts, they were not exactly in the right places. So we had to come back day after day, dig holes a little differently, put new posts in, try to get all of the panels to fit back up there. It was day after day coming back to this place and trying again and again to make it all work.
What Carl had envisioned as a one full day project turns into one full day and two half days. It was quite the experience.
Lots of weeds and bushes and
concrete.
The homeowner had said that the fence was in the wrong place. And as after we had taken down part of it, we believe the fence was actually put up in the first place by the neighbor, not by the gentleman who were taking the fence down.
And if you can see, if you see there, there's a gray pipe.
It's conduit.
Right.
Conduit for the pool that was at the neighbor's.
Former pool. It had
former
been covered.
Pool. It had
yeah,
been
there
covered.
Was water and electricity running right up against
along
that
the,
fence. So that's why we couldn't move
that's
it
why
back.
We that and the very large arborvitae trees that we were not willing to move.
That's Steve trying to get some of that concrete out of the hole with the electrical conduit running right above
yeah.
in there.
Yeah. Sawzalls are really fun. I found that out.
Me too.
You can
this
take a
is
lot
one
of
those instances
out.
Where we marked where the hole should be dug. Another group of young men who were working with us decided it was too hard to dig it where we marked it, so they dug it at a different spot, and so we had to go back in and redig
it. Which is one reason it ended up taking basically two full days.
That wheelbarrow we actually found at the site. When we pulled the fence down, that broken wheelbarrow was on the other side of the fence, hidden in bushes. It must have been sitting out there for years. And it made all the difference in the world to be able to put our little bucket in there to mix our concrete and be able to push it around with the wheelbarrow.
Yeah, that wheelbarrow was put there by God.
It
was really, really handy. We used it. And then we put it back when we were done.
That's at the end of day two.
Yes.
That's how it took all of day one to get everything down.
Down, yeah.
Day two, we got that far.
and dug the rest of the holes
right.
where they were supposed to be.
And I don't know if you remember from the previous picture, there was shrubs and bushes all along our side of that fence.
Yeah, they're not there.
Which Lou, after the bushes attacked us enough, Lou attacked the bushes and pretty much took them all out.
I am a firm believer in greenery in your yard, but not when it's in your way that much. I was trying to leave some of it, and it was not, we just mowed it all down. Some of it will come back next year. Some of it will come back in a few years, and I was fine with that because I just wanted it out of the way.
And you can see that we are reusing the same panels, but just kind of shoring them up a little bit and making them straight.
Lunch break.
Then they're eating on the job.
They did let us eat lunch. We packed a lunch every day and took it wherever we were.
Drank lots of water.
Yeah, and we drank a lot of water.
That is Robin. We have a much better picture of her later on, but that is Robin. That is Carl's wife. She's also the administrator for Rippling Hope. And this is the gentleman whose house we're working on. I wanted just to show this picture because it's a beautiful neighborhood. You can see the trees. It's an old, established neighborhood. There's a lot of importance in making sure that your fence looks good, that your front door looks good, so that people don't think your home is abandoned and come break in.
Right.
It's all about appearance.
It's vital that the front of your house and anything around your house looks like somebody's living there. That's Carl. He just sat around a whole lot.
Supervising.
Well, and let me say, too, when we got there, I think the first day we were assigned the painting job because I think Carl was trying to sort of feel us out and what he thought we could do. And so by the second day, he had decided that this was something we could tackle. He figured he had two nice, strapping young guys, and he knew Lori's experience and love of power tools.
Yeah.
And she's kind of wicked, but you look out with power tools. And so that's how I think we ended up with the fence. Because I think originally he had not planned on tackling this necessarily.
There's Lori with the pass load. So.
Yeah, she really likes that pass load.
I do love that pass load. The final panels going up.
Yeah. So we ended up with a job that I think was a lot more than what we had originally thought it was going to be. But it was actually, it was really wonderful when we actually finished because we were like, we did this. We got it. It did not defeat us.
And I'd like to say, take a good look now because if you ever see that fence again, eventually it's going to wear down and have to be replaced. And if you're the one who has to pull those posts out of the amount of concrete that we poured into those holes,
good luck with
just
that.
Turn around and run. You're not going to be able to get it out.
Two 2.5 bags.
I think it was 10 bags, 12 bags.
12 bags, I think, total.
For 10 posts.
10 posts.
Yeah.
But that is, as I said, it took us one full day, 2 half days to do the fence.
Yeah.
If we would have had more of you with us,
would have been easier. Just saying.
Hint, hint.
So this was
day three,
because day two was the fence
right.
pretty much all day. So day three we did a few different places. And this is a woman who owned the house we were working on, and she wanted us to basically just paint the security doors. Every house has a metal security door with glass or plexiglass panels, all of them. And you want to make sure it looks well-maintained because, like Lori said, you want people to know that this house is occupied and that you care about your property. So we went this day and we painted 2 security doors. There's the side door. And we did caulking around the windows to help, you know, winterize the house. Most of the houses in all the neighborhoods we worked are brick, which is actually a good thing because with as many of them as have been torched, they don't tend to spread to other houses as easily when it's on fire. So, but it was a cute little house. Most of the houses are 1.5 story. There are some in some neighborhoods that are full two story or 2.5 even. But we did the first floor, all the windows caulked, and painted the doors.
And that's the finished project.
That was the end of that project. So that was a morning. We were there from about 9 to noon.
Yeah, we had a real time constraint on this house because the woman did not want to leave her house without the security doors locked. And y'all might remember there were people across the street from that house that were there were probably some things going on in the driveway that were not legal.
Yeah.
And you could tell that she was fearful for, you know, living in her own home. And so we really rushed to get that one done because she had to go to work.
Yeah, and get the glass panels back on again.
She didn't even want the glass panels left off.
We should have waited until the next day to put the glass back on so the paint could thoroughly dry.
Right.
Because now if anybody else ever tries to take those glass panels out, it is going to be a task. They're not going to do it without breaking them. So, and then this was the second job that day. This woman that owns this house, the backstory that we were told by Carl. Rippling Hope had worked with her last summer as well, the first summer that Rippling Hope was in Detroit. And I'm not sure what they did for some stuff, I think, on the inside of the house. Mm-hmm. And when you are involved with Rippling Hope, the way that you get involved is through your neighborhood block club. And so you go through your block club, and you fill out the paperwork, and Rippling Hope gets the paperwork from the block club leaders, and then from there goes and does assessments, what can we do for these people. And so because she had been involved the year before with Rippling Hope, it saved her life. A year ago, this November, her house caught fire, middle of the night. And because she had been involved with Rippling Hope and had gotten to know her neighbors knew her schedule. And they knew that if her car was in the driveway, she was home. When the house caught fire, her car was in the driveway. The neighbors called for the fire department. And in the meantime, you know, her car was there. She was not outside. They broke into the house and saved her life. She ended up in the hospital for about a month, Carl said. I think was still, even when we were there in August, going through therapy for damage from the smoke and that kind of thing. But being involved with her neighbors saved her life. So we came this day to repair the front steps and paint both the front and the back porches. So while they were working on the front steps, Robin and I started painting the front porch. Mike and Steve were just goofing around, playing. As Steve likes to say, that shirt used to be blue, but Mike got a hold of it. That's not true. It was that color. But they went out and they painted the back porch.
They were huge.
Huge.
There
that yeah, they did an awesome job. It was.
Yeah,
it was,
the guys were real proud of themselves.
They were. But and so while they worked on that, Lori and I and Robin worked on the front and the steps. And oh, and this is a great explanation. You see a lot of this. This is a car parked in a driveway.
The same driveway
where we were working. And the sign posted in the windshield basically says something along the lines of, there is nothing left to steal in my car. Please don't break in. And some of the ones you see are worded a lot more colorfully than that.
I made sure not to put that one up.
Yes. And I'd like you to take note. The sticker down in the bottom right corner in their windshield, well, it's the left corner of the windshield, but the bottom right corner in the picture, that is a Department of Defense sticker, which means that whoever owns this car, it works for the military or has access to military bases. So that doesn't matter to people that want to steal. You've got someone who's working in the military or with the military, that doesn't matter. They're still going to break in and steal anything they can out of that truck. It's kind of sad. Here's after that step was finished. We left that day with it like that, because again, it was a partial day we spent there. And the next day, the other group of young men went back and painted that and put a second coat on the upper porch as well. There's a great story there on those steps. If you ever want to hear it, ask one of us. It's pretty funny. Then this was our third project that day. We went. This was a project that had been started the week before by another group at Rippling Hope, where they were rebuilding this back porch. You can't see it too well, but up where Carl is standing, the next post over to our, looking at the picture to our right, was the whole roof on the porch had been sagging. They put a whole new post in. They put new railings in. And they shored up the steps, and basically the steps had shifted enough and the yard had sunk enough that she needed a whole other step. That bottom step would have been about this big, and so she could no longer access her backyard easily. It was an older woman, so that we added two extra steps to get it down to a level where she could, and then we redid the railing. So I'm digging a new post hole, small, to be able to attach a railing to the side of the stairs on that side. And that's what it looked like finished. And then again, the other group went the next day and primed everything and then went back later that next day and painted it. And this woman was so grateful. She came around from the front and saw it, and she was almost in tears to see her porch and her stairs to her backyard usable again. She was so thankful. It was very touching. Who's doing this one?
I don't remember.
This is the porch.
This is the porch.
This was our last day.
We worked 11 straight hours our last day.
On this porch.
On this porch, yeah.
And that's Mr. Hall, the gentleman whose house we're working on. What you can't tell in that picture very well is the house on either side of him, the houses on either side of him have been boarded up, abandoned.
And the across the street as well.
Across the street. On his block, just on his block, there are 30 homes that are abandoned or torched.
So this was, we needed to completely tear off the front steps and redo the floor for the front porch. All
Which
of
was
the
tongue and groove.
Yeah, it was all tongue and groove. It was the original porch.
Tongue and groove.
Our guess is from the 20s. Is when it was built, and we're pretty sure everything there was original. And that was the problem. There was, at some point, I think we decided carpenter ants.
That's the only thing.
That wood was, it looked like someone had taken insulation and stuck it there, and it fell off, because that wood, if you touched it, it was just disintegrating. Just, that is the dirtiest I have ever been at the end of this day. We were, Lori and I, and Mike at one point too, underneath, coming through after we had all the floorboards off, and we redid all of the supports. We put in new joists, new supports, and then the front steps had to be completely rebuilt and tied back in again. So here, I think that's me
taking off
the boards, and we realized as we were about halfway through that we really should have numbered all of the boards. So part of them were numbered, part of them weren't. It was interesting trying to get them all back in. But here we are. We used the wood that was there and then added to it, basically added extra support on either side of the wood that was there, except at the front where the steps were. And then the other thing, too, Rippling Hope has connections with people through the church in Detroit that we stayed at, with people that are Masons, plumbers, electricians, that kind of stuff. So when we took off the front steps, we realized that it was not going to do any good to redo those front steps without also fixing the brick support on one side. So we called in, Carl called in a father and son team, who the father, who was the mason, had to be in his 80s, had to be, because the son was easily in his late 50s, and he was a plumber, but they worked on this together. And so while we were working on figuring out the wood and going and getting the wood and all that, they were working on fixing the cement on the right-hand side where the bricks were underneath the steps, where you couldn't see it without removing the steps. The bricks were gone. I mean, they were just falling apart.
Crumbling.
And they came, and as we were building the porch, rebuilding the porch, they were rebuilding that pillar for support. And that's what it looked like the next day, because we were not able to finish. Even after 11 hours there, we were not able to finish that job, which we were really bummed about. But it was our last day, and it was, we were supposed to work till 4 every day?
We were supposed to work till 4.
And we worked until almost 6 that day on that porch, and still we're not able to finish it.
Actually, we worked till 7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
quarter after 7.
That's right, yeah. So it was a very long day. It was a very grungy day. We were covered in ickiness. Yeah, it was really, really dirty. But it was fun, and it was gratifying. Once Lori got the pictures of it finished, she made sure to show us all so we could know that it got done. So
this next set of pictures are just houses in Detroit. They're not all from the same neighborhood, but every single neighborhood looks like this. So it's the only way to let you know, business after business abandoned, boarded up. Every window is out of this building. There's not a bit of glass in it. Well, maybe one window has some glass still in it. One completely.
Yeah, no glass.
It was occupied. That's not a brand new building. That was an occupied building, and everything has been stripped from it. When I went to Bosnia the first time, and I saw houses that I thought were okay, but as I got closer, I realized they had no roofs, they had no windows, they had no door, because they had been stripped in the war. And that's exactly what Detroit looks like. That house has been boarded up, part of it burned. I know you can't see it that well. Boarded up. Burned.
And we asked Carl and Corey, why are so many of them burned out? And apparently what happens is when people figure out they're empty, they go in and they squat and they start camping out there. And then if there's any neighbors around who realize, oh, hey, that house should be empty, so they call the police. The police come eventually and get the squatters out. The squatters will come back and start it on fire because they're mad they got kicked out of it, because they know they can just go find another house to squat in. So that's why there's so many of them that have been burned out. And we took a half day on Wednesday, and we worked that morning and then went and did lunch. Mike has family near there, near where we worked, about, what do we figure, 10 miles away? In a restaurant. So we had lunch there, and then after lunch there, we took a drive to other parts of Detroit and saw the same thing everywhere.
Yeah.
It
doesn't matter where you go.
Yeah. I mean, we worked in one fairly large area of North Detroit. But we went over to the eastern side, the northeast side of Detroit, and down towards
the
downtown
river.
And towards the river, and it was the same thing everywhere. We heard stories from Corey about areas where there's no power or anything because there's nobody living there. So they just turn off the power, and if you see people there, then they're squatters because no one is actually living, owning that property.
This is just a Rippling Hope keeps up with the number of homes and projects done on homes and number of volunteer hours worked, 608 projects while we were, ours weren't up there yet, 10,193 volunteer hours worked in Detroit. This is just a little sticker thing they have going of number of homes worked on in each area, and they've broken down the different neighborhoods, keeping up so that you have a little bit of a visual. That was at the end of our trip. That was Saturday morning. We were going to head back. That's R.H., Rippling Hope. R.H., that is a dog that was abandoned and in really bad shape that showed up at Carl and Robin's trailer. They live in a trailer there at the church, and they wound up taking care of R.H. R.H. truly a sign of hope. And then there's Carl and Robin and our crew with RH. And we're still happy. We're tired, but we're happy.
But we're happy. And Robin, too, besides being the administrator and also helping out on job, she's the cook.
She cooked all of our meals.
She cooked all of our meals, and which is nothing for a group our size, but they have had groups as large as
25 to 50.
Which I can't even imagine putting that many people in that building, much less trying to feed them in the kitchen. That was, if you took the serving kitchen we have here and aged it 50 to 60 years, that's the kitchen she worked in. So there was no operational dishwasher. There was fridges. There, the stove was a lot like the one at our old building at 2201, except in slightly worse shape. But it was functional, and as long as you knew that the temperature wasn't quite right and you knew where to set the temperature, you were fine.
Right. So why should we care about this, right? I mean, Detroit is in Michigan. We live in Minnesota. We have our own problems in Minnesota. We should care because Detroit is our neighbor. In 1950, Detroit had the fifth largest population in the United States. Today it ranks 18th. They've gone from close to 2 million to 700,000.
Most of whom live in poverty.
Right. The unemployment rate more than doubled since 2000. It's now 18.6%, which I believe is probably higher because jobs are dropping off every day, except for maybe right downtown Detroit. More than 90% of crimes in Detroit go unsolved. The Michigan average is 30.5% solved. Detroit average is 8.7% solved. Nobody cares because there's so many crimes. The average wait time for police to respond to calls for assistance is 58 minutes in Detroit. The national average is 11 minutes.
And there's squad cars. I mean, you've seen squads around here. Most people, you know, you see them drive by, and you realize they have squads these days have computers in them. They have cameras. If there are any computers in Detroit squads, it's probably only a handful.
And the cars are in horrible shape.
They're in horrible shape.
In fact, when we got home, and I, you know, living in northeast Minneapolis, you hear sirens, and I was never so grateful to hear sirens because I realized if I'm hearing sirens, that means our services are working and people are responding. We maybe heard a siren once the whole time we were in Detroit, which was not a good thing. 33% of the ambulances are in service. 40%, which I believe is higher, of the city street lights aren't working. 78,000 buildings are abandoned, and 66,000 lots are vacant.
And which means those lots originally had something on them, whether it was a commercial building or a house. Right. Now that's gone. There's a lot of empty blocks.
And many people say, well, why don't the people that live in Detroit leave, right? If it's so bad, why don't you go out, go live in the suburbs, go somewhere else where the crime isn't so high? The people that are left in Detroit cannot leave. They don't have the funds. It's the poorest of the poor, except for right downtown Detroit where they're building some million-dollar high-rises. And then the edge of the suburbs, which are incredibly beautiful, like Gross Point, Michigan. Everything in between is referred to as a wasteland. And it's the poorest of the poor. They can't leave. They don't have anywhere to go. They don't have a vehicle. They don't have the money. And it's their home.
And as many people heard just before we went on this mission trip, Detroit declared bankruptcy. And it was interesting to drive that half day we took on Wednesday. As we were driving around, one of the places we drove was literally on the border of Detroit and Grosse Pointe. Grosse Pointe is like Edina or Minnetonka here, and they are literally right smack up next to each other, Detroit and Grosse Pointe. And we're driving down the street that divided the two, and on this side is Detroit. There are no trees. There are abandoned buildings. There are abandoned businesses. You look down a street and there might be a house or two and the rest were empty lots where there used to be houses. And you look on the other side to Grosse Pointe and there are streetlights, there are trees, there are businesses. It's literally like this invisible line has been drawn and Detroit has nothing and Grosse Pointe has everything. It's amazing. I've never seen such an obvious division of wealth. It was crazy.
So we should care, because not that it could happen to the Twin Cities area, but who's to say it couldn't, right? The right circumstances fall into place, it could. And if we're not caring for each other. The other reason is that I do believe in this commandment. One of the scribes came near and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, he asked him, which commandment is the first of all? Jesus answered, the first is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. The people that we met are our neighbors. They are part of our family now. We care for them. We know them. The people of Detroit are our family. And we love them as much as we love ourselves. And we want for them what we want for ourselves. And we truly, the four of us, I think I can say this for the four of us, we feel called to go and serve in communities like this, that circumstances, some in their control, many out of their control, is why they're in the situation that they're in. We have a survey for anyone that's interested in going with us next year. To choose several weeks that you might be interested in going, so we can go ahead and select our week and get going on the fundraising. I ask that you continue to hold this mission trip in your prayers and the people of Detroit, and you know that you are invited to go and serve with us as we go again.
And it wasn't all sadness and seriousness. We had a lot of fun. We did. We got to know each other a lot better. We got some great stories. We got some little bit of, you know.
Hiccups.
What's that?
Hiccups.
Oh, yeah, we had a few hiccups. But I was thinking we have a few things, you know, that if I ever needed anything on, you know, Lori's kind of a crazy driver sometimes. And, you know, anyway, but it was a lot of fun. And we had a wonderful opportunity on our way home. We stopped at the church in Marion, Iowa for the night. And that was a lot of fun, too. So it was fun, besides all the work and the dirt and the hopelessness that you saw everywhere. There was a lot of hope, and that's where the rippling hope comes from. You start with one spot of hope, and it ripples out, and it was a wonderful trip.
It makes you feel good.
Yes. Thank you all.